I don't know that we improve. I don't know that we improve the joint, just to be quite frank. So yes, it is the current version of the hire.
Hello and welcome to episode 211, the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. It's Saturday the 30th of March. It's a holiday here, and happy Easter to you if you celebrate. I'm your host, Ian Trusker. I'm not a rock star, but I am a CMO and trusted advisor. And on this podcast, with the help of my chums, we share the marketing street knowledge that will inspire your inner rock star. Come and say hello. You can find links to me and my guests in the show notes at rockstarcmo.com or on LinkedIn at rockstarcmo. And we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. This week in the marketing studio, Jeff Clark and I have a chat about analysts and influencers in B2B. And the Rockstar CMO virtual bar, Robert Rose, has a thought about ad tech and data over a spicy cocktail. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Right, let's start the show and join our resident strategy advisor and former Forrester Research Director, Jeff Clark, in our marketing studio. Good
afternoon. Is it morning or afternoon? And who cares? Because you're listening to this whenever you're listening to it. But for me, it actually is afternoon. So welcome, Ian, to the studio. Thank you.
I've noticed that you struggled with the name of the studio because last week it was the Rockstar Studio. I think it's supposed to be the Rockstar CMO Studio now.
Still, you know, mate, Randy, you don't know what
one of my strong points.
Well, you're not even sure what time of day it is, so you must be having a good day.
See,
I actually don't know what day of the week it is because we're recording this on Friday, which is a holiday, and I've been wandering around thinking it's Saturday all day, so it's been crazy. So happy Easter to everybody who's listening. And
happy
celebrate,
Easter,
obviously. So, well, thank you, Jeff. So this week, we might be a bit disorganized about what time or day is or what the studio is called, but what we do know is what we're going to discuss.
So what we're talking about.
So we're going to talk about five effing things about the influencer landscape. It's a rabbit hole that we skipped over last week when you were talking about, interviewing me about writing a book. And we often talk about the roles of analysts, consultants, bloggers, and anyone with a platform to talk about marketing, a bit like us. But we've never really drilled down into this topic and analyst relations and all the good stuff that goes around it. So that's what we're going to talk about this week. And also how to best leverage them, obviously. So what say you, Jeff?
Oh, hang on a minute.
Well, first thing, like,
it's the weather. Warm, gray spring day.
Good. Well, we've got to get the agenda sorted out. Sorry. For regular listeners, you know we have to cover the weather. The weather here, bright blue sky at the moment, but has been raining today. So there we go. So what say you, Jeff?
It helps you understand what time of the year that we're actually doing this. But it is being Easter. It just popped into my head as you were doing the intro is that we're led down a rabbit hole and it's Easter. We're, rabbits and, our productivity of the species is part of the Easter celebration. I mean, it's one of the aspects from way back.
Yeah.
So,
very good.
Yeah. So anyway, with that aside, I think the place to start is knowing the landscape of what we mean by influencers, because I think I mean, it's changed. And, you know, yeah. Many people may be, you know, certainly up to speed with it. But I think in the past, you know, we used to think of the big influencers as the research analysts, like at the Foresters and Gartners. And there used to be many more firms like them in the B2B world before things consolidated. There's also, you know, the advisory services. You know, I came from Serious Decisions, which is folded in under Forrester, and it works on a slightly different model. But there are others out there, you know, Lux Research, eMarketer, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but I think that there's just so many people with the advent of blogging and social media and et cetera, et cetera, that, you know, you get into consultants and certainly, you know, the media themselves have turned from, you know, the traditional sort of format to online editorial, and hopefully the media has influencers here, somebody who has a name that can draw people to their content. So, you know, it's just really expanded. And I think, you know, we're, for better or worse, we're part of that expansion, aren't we, Ian?
Yeah, I guess we are. I guess we are. I mean, we don't really cover vendors in any detail, do we? Or anything like that. Right. But we certainly can help people out with vendor selections and that kind of stuff. But we don't really comment on specific tools. But you do see a lot of that. And I also think, I mean, like you were saying, it used to be the old days, wasn't it? There was the old guard of the research analyst, and that was pretty much it. But then today, it's not just the democratization that anybody can write a blog. It's more about anybody can start to build trust with an audience and be trusted by an enterprise to advise them on this kind of stuff. And they become influential, right? We shouldn't confuse content production with influence, right? So just because you can write a blog doesn't make an influence, all right? So I think point there about knowing the landscape, it isn't just knowing who is a blogger in your space. It's actually who are the influential bloggers in your space, right? So I think it's really interesting. And also, you're seeing a lot of churn within some of the large analyst firms, right? And
absolutely,
people are setting up on their own, and and a lot of them are very good. And so you're seeing a lot more independence, aren't you? People that are helping out this stuff. So yes. Yeah, so what's our general advice about knowing the landscape, Jeff?
I think the first piece of advice really is to create an analyst or slash influencer as a persona in your marketing campaign planning. So, okay. You know, when you think about the decision makers and the champions within the organization, and there are, you know, there are influencers within an organization, right? You know, you may say that somebody in IT is an influencer to marketing, to buying marketing technology.
Yeah.
They might be a gatekeeper, but you got to think about those influencers that are external to the customer, because the customer may be consulting with them, maybe, you know, going to them to find, you know, who's the vendors in this particular solution area, you know, and so in doing their research, you got to make sure that person, the influencer, the analyst is in your in your realm of personas that you are trying to communicate to and influence. You're trying to influence the influencers or influencing the buying decision, which Absolutely. Gets complicated.
Absolutely. And I've started, when I do persona work, I've started sort of labeling whether this person is a spark, i.e. that are they the ones that create the idea that change needs to be done? And also, you know, whether they're a decision maker, but also whether they're an influencer. So that, like you say, there are people within the organization that are going to be influencers. They may not be decision makers, but they'll be influencers. But you must have your analyst influencer as a separate persona, because they're part of your audience, right? And you need to figure out what their needs are, and so you can create content for them. So that's thing number one, because I did say five effing things. So they're not really, they're just five things we thought of. So I don't even know how to classify them, really. They're not fundamentals. They're just things we thought of. So thing number two, and this is a question for you, really, a bit unfair, Jeff, to be honest with you, but are analysts still relevant? Those classic analysts, are they still relevant?
I think I'm under a agreement to say yes. Having once worked at Forrester, but I think that and we've both been on the inside and outside of analyst firms, so I think it's legitimate for us to say that, you know, the power of their ability to do the research and review the landscape, again, in a particular solution area you're looking for. And, you know, they do the, you know, Forrester does the Wave, Gartner does the MQ. When I was at Forrester, they were doing new tech and now tech reviews, capability maps, so you could map, so you could kind of think of a list of capabilities in a particular solution set and how vendors, you know, how they, you know, support those. So you can kind of get the difference between, like, if you're talking about digital asset management, I mean, some vendors come from a different side of solving the problem than others. So you kind of, you know, they help you in the selection process. And, you know, I mean, we throw in the notes this question, are they overrated? And my answer would be that your mileage is going to vary based on what, you know, what the solution, you know, what research you're doing in what particular solution area. Because I think in some areas, they are right on top of things. In other areas, you know, they can help you say who's in the market. But, you know, you really have to, I mean, you really have to not just rely on their advice. You've got to be doing your own independent research.
Well, I think
to find out what's the best match for you.
Yeah, I think you need to also look at the influencers analyst background, right? Because one of the things we were talking about was that week before last, we were talking about the hard knocks that we'd experienced through around marketing technology, right? And it got me thinking about those hard knocks, and I wrote about it in our newsletter, was really those are the things you're going to learn from. And I'm a little bit concerned when you see an analyst that has no industry expertise whatsoever and has just really kind of come up through the ranks of being an analyst or consultant or had some kind of marketing education. Because I think that, I don't know whether it's good or not, and you may have might have an opinion on that, but they don't. How do you take advice from somebody who has never had that problem or has never been, you know, threatened with being fired because they didn't make their number that quarter? You know, that sort of pressure, those kind of stakes. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a continuum of people who've had the practical experience. They've been in your shoes. When I worked at Serious Decisions, that was one thing we really stressed. I mean, our analysts were people that came out of the industry, and so things were less theoretical. They became more practical. However, the longer you're within an analyst organization, and you know you're talking to customers all the time, but the longer you're in there, the more you end up developing theories, and you get a little further away from the practical aspects of implementing your advice. And that's where I say, you know, the traditional analyst firms, I mean, they're really good at doing a ton of research and talking to all the vendors in a particular area and helping, you know, suss out some of the differentials and things like that. But if you ask them, you know, well, what should I buy? I mean, they're not going to give you really necessary practical advice. I mean, that's where you've really got to, you talk to, you know, talk to colleagues or talk to people in other organizations, get references and talk to them because they're going to be, you know, much more in tune with, like, if you're implementing, you know, I was always think back to things that are very process oriented, you know, DAMs and marketing resource management and process automation. It's like, there's a ton of things that are great in theory, but it's like, could this actually work at my size organization?
Yeah.
You know?
But I think with things like vendor selection and stuff like that and implementing best practices, often a good idea to have a third party, isn't it, to drive that sort of thing and help you just remain objective and to drive a process. And I think that's probably true of a lot of marketing disciplines and processes. Really, what you're doing is getting help you're not outsourcing your brain. You're just getting somebody who can help structure what you're trying to get done, right, I think. Yeah, that's where the problem would be.
I was going to ask you. I mean, is you being a CMO, being in a position where you may have to be the final decision maker, and other people are coming up with, geez, we need to do X, Y, Z. What's your point of view as to how you would say, let's get influencers?
Well, I've had some interesting experiences I remember we briefed a particular analyst, and And he'd tell you that what you're saying is complete rubbish. And then you'd have a briefing with him again in a couple of months' time, and he'd repeat back what you told him a few months ago. And all of a sudden, it's the coolest thing in the world. And why aren't we doing more of it? Right. And I absolutely have that experience. And I think there is an element of the analyst is soaking up what they're hearing from their customers and from vendors, and is great as sort of giving you the judge of where the zeitgeist is. And I think a lot of time you sort of put your ego at the door with that sort of thing. You don't get annoyed. Like I've worked with other senior executive CEOs who've like been swearing and going, I've fucking told them that. And then it's like, yes, you did. That's not the way this game works, right? So I think, so that's why that's sort of my point of view. But also, you know, you can't deny the power of the wave. I mean, or the MQL is because enterprise buyers are quite often risk averse. And I think that if they can look at a report from somebody who's incredibly reputable and trustworthy, which is really what we're talking about here about influence, it's about trust. And it makes a big difference. And I've been working with a couple of vendors, one specifically who's recently made good grounds on the Forrester Wave in their category. And they're seeing a whole lot more RFPs coming through. And it just is.
Yeah.
It's just, you don't want it to be true sometimes, but it just is, you know. So that's my view, yeah. It's expensive. And I don't mean the normal sort of expensive, like, oh, you pay the analysts and you get on the wave. That I don't believe that to be true. It's expensive in that you have to pay a lot of attention to the process, to the briefings, to make sure that you're doing and you're taking every opportunity for them to understand what your value proposition is, but it pays off if you can get into the wave, I think. That's, I mean, I had many points of view. That was your question, wasn't it? What's your advice? I mean, you've looked at this from the other side, so what's your advice?
Yeah. Well, I certainly, I mean, I've been at a couple companies that, you know, were basically living and dying based on their position in the MQ or the wave. And one product in particular, I won't name names, you know, when it fell off the MQ, we basically lost to the big gorillas in the market that could execute better. You know, I know that, you know, when you develop a good relationship with an analyst and a team that is working on those reports, it's really helpful. I mean, to me, it's always been helpful in kind of the give, get, which we may get into a little bit later, but it's like, you know, they give you information, you give them information, and they, since they've been talking to a lot of people, they know when the information you're giving them is BS versus when it's not. So I totally agree that it's, you know, they still provide a valuable, you know, service to the buyers out there. And I think, you know, I mean, our kind of a general advice about this from a marketer perspective is you got to do the research to who your customers and prospects are listening to.
But that's going back to our thing number one, isn't it? Knowing the landscape. So I think on the point of relevancy, it seems that our advice is yes, analysts are still relevant, right? And the other thing about their relevancy is I've seen you know, vendors do competitive research and assume they know a lot about their competitors. The people that know the most about your competitors are the buyers and the analysts, right? And so that's where I think there's a huge amount of value there. So that's our number one, number two. So we've agreed that we do need to work with analysts. So what do we need to consider when we're doing that, Jeff, and from your experience?
Yeah, I think this is where, you know, your analyst relations role or sometimes a PR firm that works, you know, that does analyst work and or influencer work. It's really important to partner with them. And I guess this is from both sides of being the vendor who's trying to get the name for themselves or the, you know, the buyer, and certainly, you know, companies like Forrester and Gartner. It's too bad we keep mentioning them, but, you know, they're ones we're most familiar with. I mean, they have people that do a really good job at helping and making buying decisions. And so, you know, you need to be able to engage with them, understand, you know, what are the product, you know, updates, roadmaps, what are the unique value propositions, what are the market insights, you know, other customer experience. I mean, that's what analysts are taking in droves, and they're able to impart that to customers who are on that that buying journey.
Well, I mean, this is why we have them as their persona, that persona, right? Because we got to make sure that we're responding to their needs, because they are going to consume our content outside of the briefing if it's a good analyst anyway, right? So we got to make sure that content is available. But I also think that one of the things that I found, I mean, I was an analyst briefly with Gil Bain many years ago, was when I was being briefed, it's don't just tell me the trends in the market that everybody else is telling me. Tell me what's different about yourself. And also, I had to convince people sometimes to show me their product. They just wanted to show me slides of their thought leadership. And the problem when you're a vendor is that you're actually in this little bubble, a bit like what I was just saying about competitive analysis. You know, you're in a bit of a silo. You don't know what everybody else is, you know, and you think what you're saying is completely unique. And what you end up with as an analyst is 20 minutes of, well, this is the state of the landscape. Well, yeah, of course I fucking know that. I'm an analyst, right? So I think when we talk about what to consider when working with analysts is, what can you offer them that's different from the last 2 hours they just spent with another vendor, right? And I also think it's important to know the difference between the different types of engagement. Particularly, I think it's with Forrester, isn't it? Where, you know, they're very clear. A briefing is something specific, and advisors are very specific. So what's your general advice when working with an analyst?
I think that the advice is to work with, whether it's you're an analyst relations manager, PR firm, to understand the analysts and what they need to get in that sort of give-get relationship. And again, as you're talking about the briefing or the advisory, it's like, what are the things we need to provide them? What are we expecting them to provide back to us? And so you need that liaison, that go-between, to really make sure you're setting that relationship up right.
Right. So that's our first three. So knowing the landscape, our second thing, are analysts still relevant? And then thing number three was what to consider when working with analysts. I think there's some stuff that we could dive into there about what it is that analysts actually need. So I think we need to add some detail there, but I'm in the interest of time. When we move on to thing number four, so is this going to be different from working? Is it different working with influencers than working with analysts? Because obviously with the analysts, as we were trying to drive through to you there, it's more of a formal structure. But so what is it that we need to consider when we're working with influencers?
Yeah, with other influencers, I think one of the main differentials is that they're probably not going to be doing as much of their own. I mean, they may do personal research, but they don't really have the staff, the bandwidth to do a lot of in-depth research around customers and vendors. They certainly will get a good sense, have a good sense of what's going on in the market. What they really want is exposure to your customers. So whether it's speaking, content opportunities, you know, this is where, you know, influencers can be who, you know, who've done the work to gain a following, can be part of, you know, your own content marketing, because they're looking at ways of selling their service, of really providing more content than they are in terms of providing a lot of, you know, sort of consulting help.
Yeah, and I think that was, that's one of the key things with influencers, isn't it? So for example, if you were to work with a Forrester analyst, that relationship is very structured. Whereas I think with an influencer, you can be a bit more flexible. So for example, you can pay for them to speak at your event, or you can pay for them to write some content for you, or as you say, they're also looking to build trust and relevance themselves in the market. So if you can introduce them to your customers so they can write their case studies and stuff, then that's the sort of, and they're also looking for consulting work as well, aren't they, themselves? So it's more of a fluid relationship of quid pro quo, isn't it, of give get.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I think go ahead.
No, and as we were saying earlier on about building out our personas, I think that your influencers need to be a solid part of your content marketing plan, right? So not only maybe you don't invite them to speak on your behalf, but make sure you know who the influencers are. So you're quoting their work, you're mentioning them, you're engaging with them. And so they're absolutely wrapped up in your content marketing plan, I think, as well. And this is actually just to kind of tie back to our episode last week. I think this is where a lot of your authors of books fall into, because they're probably not somebody who has, you know, again, a formal analyst title at one of the big analyst firms. They're probably someone who's on their own, and they've done a lot of work in an area, and they've built up a following, and they've been publishing, and so they know things, and they can talk, but it's a much different animal than your formal analyst firms.
Yeah, and I also think that in this sort of more sort of gray area, as it were, not quite so structured, you've also got to think about what it is you want them to help you to promote. Because it might be that you actually just want them to help promote your thought leadership or your content. You know, not some influencers are clearly not going to want to be a shill for your product and service and vendor, because they sit across a bunch of those. But they may help support your point of view in the market, right? And your position in the category from that perspective.
And you have to watch out the ones that just want to be a shill for your product.
Yeah, it's true.
Because they will lose credibility, and yeah, maybe that loss of credibility will rub off on you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's very common. Again, that's something I think we can probably dig into a bit more about. How to work with influencers is really quite different from analysts. But the important thing is that you include them in the same program, right? Your AR,
yeah,
PR, IR program. So what would your final, what would your advice be on that then with influencers?
I think it's the same as with analysts in terms of understanding, you know, you want to work with a liaison that can help you navigate that landscape and understand what the give-give relationship is with the influencer.
Yeah.
And again, understand what you're in it for, because you're in it, because we've been referring to, you know, speaking opportunities and helping you develop content. If that's what you're in it for, then go for it.
Well, it's all about goals, isn't it? It's understanding what their goals are and what your goals are from this thing, right? You can't do it. You can't build a give-get relationship without knowing both of those things, can you?
Yep.
So then moving on to our thing number five, and this is the idea that vendors can be influencers. And I think that we've covered some good work from some vendors on this show. So do you think vendors can be influencers?
I think they can. And one of the reasons is because, as we've both experienced, is that people from, you know, the big analyst firms have ventured off to vendors and vice versa. And so just like in the world of lobbying our governments, there's kind of an open door policy. I should say, whatever policy, it's not a policy. It's just that's the fact. And so some really good thought leaders have moved into working with vendors, and they have brought some of their discipline practices with them. In other words, doing good research, publishing papers, and publishing, edge speaking and blogs and stuff like that really have good evidence behind them. And certainly, I don't know, it was a month or so ago, we talked about a report that came out from Sixth Sense with the, you know, was authored by an analyst who came from Serious Decisions, Kerry Cunningham. And certainly they're not the only example of this, but, you know, they went and said, we need somebody who's a thought leader who's going to help us, probably help us with our product direction, but also going to be help us to get the message out and help us understand, since it's all about what to do with the data we're producing, help customers understand, you know, what they should be thinking of in the future of how to use data.
Yeah. And also, I think if we put the weight of our marketing behind, because I mean, part of the influencer analyst game, right, is the category and the definition of the category and what that is. And I think vendors can do a lot to shape what the category means. I mean, we saw that with conversational marketing and Drift, right? They kind of created that category. And I think that if you can if you can drive that as a vendor with some willing analysts, right? It's a contrivance to do that. But I also really like, as you were saying, I really like what Sixth Sense are doing. And because it does seem they've brought that discipline over of doing research and giving away great research, which is a great content marketing strategy, right? So I think that's the core of it. So what's your advice for vendors that want to be influencers?
For the vendor itself is I think that, again, you've got to, I mean, it's all about the personal, the personality, if that is the right word to put to it. But it's like there are people out there who've developed a following, tied to an individual that has like been, sort of pushing the envelope on certain concepts. And so from the vendor's perspective, they're extremely valuable to have on staff, and there's lots of different ways that those mm-hmm. arrangements happen. And certainly, we've worked at vendors where, we actually had the tools to actually develop interesting, good, authentic research. And so the only buyer beware is you got to be able to tell the difference between that and somebody who put together a quick white paper on some data points and, referring to somebody else's research and trying to be the thought leader.
Well, that's splendid. So that was five things about influencers and the influencer landscape and analysts. And we come to our final agenda point. It's time for our song.
The final thing.
So the final thing.
I think you're the one that came up with this one, and it is full of influencers. I'll let you introduce it.
Well, yeah, I came across this. It's called The Influencers, and it's by Bootsy Collins, West Coast Stone, Wiz Khalifa, Dave Stewart, Snoop Dogg, and Fat Zama. And it's from 2024.
And here we're still in March. Wow.
So I'm going to play out with that because it's a really cool track. And I think really relevant for the conversation that there is a huge number of influencers playing.
What's that? You're right. And we tried to listen to the lyrics to pull out some gems, but couldn't find anything.
All right. So we'll play out with that. And then will I see you here in the studio next week?
I'll be here.
All right, mate. I'll see you there.
I'll welcome you in.
Okay.
That's my mating call. Shout out to my Falkalotopus. You know that I'm your Falkalotopus. I'm in heat. Don't want to cheat. I'm a vegetarian, but I do like meat. Yeah. Come on over here, don't be discreet. I need you to sit down here, girl. Let me rub your feet.
You ain't never been with nobody like me. I'ma run it back from the G to the P. I add a little bass, then I put it on key. I put it on a note on a boat, now we floating high.
Thank you, Jeff. And that was a tiny bit of The Influencers by Bootsy Collins and the gang from 2024. And I admit, it was a bit of a ramble through that topic this week. I hope you found it helpful. If you have a suggestion for a topic, I'd love to hear from you. You know where to find us, rockstarcmo.com. Right, it's that time of the week to wind down in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar and join the chief troublemaker at the content advisory, Robert Rose, for a cocktail and a marketing call. Beanie Roberts, what are you drinking?
Oh, hello, my friend, and welcome to the bar. I mean, it's an Easter. It seems to be like you've got an Easter festivity going on here. There's rabbits running around here. There's chickens. There's eggs being. I actually don't know what the loud sounds are in an Easter thing, but I'm sure you'll come up with something that are making this place feel like an Easter spring joyous.
Easter parade of a pub.
Yeah, like an Easter parade. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it's organ music for Jesus coming back. I'm not sure really actually what.
Let's see, because it's going to be really hard because rabbits don't really make that much noise.
That's right. They really don't. They really don't. There's not a lot
There's, perhaps that's
so the I, maybe it's just the quiet. Maybe it's just so quiet
yes,
around here. That's really what it is. It's the it's the chickens and the rabbits being quiet. Yeah.
Yes, maybe that's the
The sound effect this week is deadly quiet.
Yeah, so this week's going to be really easy to edit.
It should be. I think it should be. In any event, I have a classic cocktail for us for Easter weekend. Yes. It is one that I've had for years on Easter Sunday, and not because of the name of it, but because of just it seems to be the perfect for an Easter breakfast brunch. And of course, it's the Bloody Mary, right? It is very, very one of my favorite cocktails. But and this one is going to be a little different. We call it the Jerk Spiced Bloody Mary. It's really good. So now Bloody Marys are, of course, you know, salad in a glass in many cases, where you get, you know, a lot of things. But basically, it all starts with your base, and lots of people have very passionate about their Bloody Marys and their base, whether it's V8 juice or whether it's just regular tomato juice or anything like that. But basically, you start with whatever you like there, tomato juice, V8 juice, etc. And then, of course, the jerk part of this is jerk seasoning. And jerk seasoning, of course, is like jerk chicken or it's a very particular spice, very popular in the South here. And then, of course, a little celery salt, a little Worcestershire sauce, a little lemon juice, hot pepper sauce, if you like that. And then, of course, a little bit, just a little bit of light or dark rum in there as you put in with, of course, the beautiful vodka or whatever it is you have in your Bloody Mary. Combine all that together, of course, stir it, shake it, whatever you want. All of that together, put it in a big stalk of celery, and away you go with a lime wedge, and you have your Bloody Mary ready to roll.
Oh, I love the sound of that. I'm going to have to suggest that to my wife. My wife's family are from Jamaica, and so we do enjoy some jerk. And actually, it falls to me, actually, to cook our jerk chicken, weirdly enough. And a bit of jerk sauce, a jerk seasoning in your Bloody Mary.
Sounds that's right. Amazing. That is exactly. That's really all it is adding jerk seasoning to your regular classic Bloody Mary. Yeah.
Well, you put rum in it as well, which isn't normal.
Put a little rum in it just to it sort of cools things down. As from the heat perspective.
But whatever
else you like in there, go for it.
Nice. And where will we be drinking these?
We are going to be drinking these here in Los Angeles, and I'll tell you why, because it is almost a weather tradition here that Easter Sunday is absolutely spectacular weather. And so we will find ourselves in a bar or a wonderful restaurant. One of my favorite restaurants is down in Beverly Hills, and they have an amazing Bloody Mary. And we'll sit out on the patio and enjoy the amazing spring Los Angeles, Southern California weather, and just chit chat for hours, because it's the kind of thing where you go in at around 10 a.m., 11 a.m., and you're there till 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and then you just go home and sleep.
Nice, what we call over here a bottomless brunch.
There it is. Oh, I like that. Oh, I like that.
Nice. And after a couple of hours of just catching up and people watching in this beautiful LA restaurant, what will we be talking about today?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit. I mean, this, you know, it's probably too technical to talk about over Bloody Marys, but we're going to do it anyway, which is what's going on in the world of ad tech and data at the moment. And there's a really interesting thing that came out. It was a couple of weeks ago now. The IAB, which is the Internet Advertising Bureau, of course, they released their 2024 State of Data Report. You know, everybody seems to have a State of Data Report. Well, they have one of their own. And basically, it's how the digital ad industry is working with privacy and the, you know, sort of deprecation of the third-party cookie from Google. And the interesting and the surprising finding and the thing that got me sort of up in arms about it was the study found that 94% of their survey respondents, so basically everybody, say that they expect Google to eventually eliminate third-party cookies eventually, right? And the interesting thing there is, of course, Google has already started to do that this year. But only 42% of those same people believe that Google are going to do it by the end of this year, 2024. But here's the thing. It's already happening, right? It reminds me very much of that scene. Did you see the movie Don't Look Up?
Yeah.
It's a great movie, wonderful movie. Yeah. It's Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence. They're in the President of the United States, who, of course, is being played by Meryl Streep, and she's amazing. Yeah. And basically, they're saying there's a 100% chance a comet's going to hit the Earth. And then Leonardo DiCaprio goes, well, it's 99.78% to be exact. And the president replies, fine, let's call it 70% and call it a day, right? We'll just move on. And then Meryl Streep goes, you know, we'll sit tight and assess. And that's exactly what this study is saying that marketers are doing. Basically, there's this comet called third-party cookie deprecation, privacy legislation, inability to get first-party data in the world of all this noise of digital media. And basically, everybody's going, meh, we'll sit tight and assess. And this is the thing. We are missing out because the idea here is that there are brands, agencies, digital publishers, and everybody is going to be affected by this. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, we don't see it right now because of the fact that so little of it is actually happening, right? It's very hard to see. It's like a comet coming, right? You don't see it until it's too late. And the thing is, because nobody's really preparing for it, and this gets to the sort of the heart of it, it was fascinating. Deeper in the report, they said, well, what technologies, they asked these marketers, like, what technologies are you actually looking at in terms of, you know, handling privacy and first party data and getting good about, you know, a world after the third party cookie? So the top answers were web analytics, which is just really scary in terms of that's the top, because if they're saying that they need to develop web analytics, it means they don't have it. And so so not even web analytics is really replete throughout the organization yet, but web analytics was the number one. And then basically customer data platforms, which are amazing to me that everybody says they want to get a customer data platform, except that nobody's actually buying customer data platforms. Customer data platforms are like the sexiest, coolest things that no one is doing. And all of these, and then the rest of it were all the usual suspects like CRM and email marketing data and data pools and data lakes and data warehouses and all this stuff. And it's the interesting thing to me there is that that all feels like a grasp, right? It all feels like, well, we're just trying to do anything, or we feel like we should be doing everything that we can. There's no priorities. There's no focus. There's no working to bring all these platforms, whether it's your website, your email newsletter, your, you know, your customer data platform, your blog, your whatever. There's no focus on bringing that stuff together and figuring it out. And you and I have been through these projects. These are not small projects.
No.
These are big projects, connecting all these things together into getting a look at your, you know, your database, what's going on with your customers, and all those kinds of things. And it's just, like I said, it's like that movie, Don't Look Up. It's not maybe it's coming. It's coming. It's already starting to happen. Google has already started with 2% of the Chrome browsers now completely obfuscating the third-party cookie, and it's only going to get more and more and more. And so it's just a reminder that we need to get going on this. And by the way, really nice, actually, and really weirdly refreshing to see the IAB reinforcing this and saying basically companies need to do this or, you know, get left behind. And I couldn't agree more, of course, because most of the time I disagree with the IAB and their sort of attachment to the ad tech industry. But this is them saying you need to sort out your first party data and you need to sort it out now. And I couldn't agree more. It's just good marketing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm surprised that I'm surprised there is an apathy around this, to be honest with you, because I just, as you finished that by saying this is just good marketing, right? So what are people doing? How, you know, why aren't we using this as an excuse to go to our senior colleagues and say, look, we need to invest in this now?
You know what I think it is? I think it's
it's one of those change management initiatives that affects so many, you know, the biggest challenge arguably in the last 20 years is the siloification of marketing into the various digital silos that now exist, right? Somewhere along the line in 2007 to 2013 to 2015, you know, somewhere in that sort of 8 to 10 year period there, we got wrapped around the axle of dividing up marketing into the buyer's journey, right? So now there's a brand team and there's a web team and there's an email team and there's a, you know, and there's a blog team and a content team and a demand gen team and a, all these teams that are siloed off from each other that all own various parts of the technology, right? Technology and the platforms that are used for marketing. And the problem with that, of course, is that they all have their own way of doing things. They all have their own databases. They all have their own, there's no connected, there's no enterprise level connection between any of those things. And so any one of those teams goes, hey, let's join it all together and make one cohesive infrastructure. They start listing out all the things that they need to do and the cost of all that, and it's enormous, and it's hard, and it's going to employ the cooperation of all those teams working together, you know, and it's just they just look at it and go, it's they throw up their hands and go, it's just we can't do it. We're just I mean, I've literally had clients say, this is wonderful what you're prescribing, but we can't do this. It's too big.
Do you think also, and I don't know, do you think also there's two sides to this sort of relationship with Google? Is one side of it is that people don't actually believe that it's happening, even though it's, the evidence is clearly there, right?
Right.
And the second part is, do you think there's like a in big tech we trust that, okay, so Google are going to take away this, but still Google need to do something so there'll be a something. Do you know what I mean? Like they'll, you know, it'll work itself out.
I think there is some of that for sure. Yeah, I think there's some. But interestingly, what the study found was, so Google has been desperately trying to get people into this, what they call the Google sandbox, right? Which is the ability for you to, you know, there's sort of the Google sandbox, which is the their answer at the moment to the third-party cookie, where you go in and you put in your data and it matches it. And basically gives you the ability to target people, but you don't know who they are, right? That kind of thing. Same thing with clean room. There's clean room technology that there are, you know, solutions out there where you can go and a publisher can go and you sort of, you know, it's a little more complex than this, but to simplify it, you sort of sit in a virtual room and you put all your data into a bucket and they put all their data into a bucket. And then the technology sort of matches it up so that you can do targeting on the publisher's website or your website, but nobody knows who it was, right? The all, no first party data identifiable information gets exchanged. Right. And those things to me are hacks, ultimately in the long run, because they all depend on, they all depend on sort of everybody behaving. Basically, which is unlikely in this, you know, in this scenario, and so what we're, and it also punts it down the field, right? It basically punts the need for, so media companies, of course, are going to love these solutions, right? Google's going to love this solution as a media company. Yeah. Other publishers and media companies are going to love this because what it means is that their first party data becomes the premium, and if you can somehow convince brands and marketing teams that they don't need to collect first-party data and serve up the ability to have those addressable audiences in a personal way, then they'll constantly have to come and pay for it, right? So it keeps it keeps the business model alive for those media companies. And Google's the perfect example of this, right? Where if you can go target people, but you have to do it in the ecosystem of Google, like YouTube and Gmail and all of that, well, then that works great for Google, but it doesn't work so great for you from a cost perspective. So the mandate is clear. It's just, goodness gracious, it seems so hard and you know, but it has to be done. It has to be done.
Yeah. I mean, it's it, and that's a similar model to what it's like for us for B2B marketing, isn't it? And that LinkedIn is that walled garden that we need to play in. And as you say,
it's expensive to do it, but you know, they own that relationship. We've got to move to owning that relationship ourselves and having that direct connection, so we're not
at least have an attempt at it, right? I mean, you know, use it for what it's good for. Like LinkedIn is a perfect example that you're using, because we, as small businesses, you know, you and I, we definitely use LinkedIn to, you know, address an audience, right? Mm-hmm. And build our business and drive leads and create value and do all the things that we need to do as marketers. But at least we have the acknowledgement that at any time, like tomorrow, LinkedIn could go away. And if LinkedIn goes away, well, then what do you got? And the answer is, well, you better have an email list, you better have a physical list, you better have a Rolodex of people who want to hear from you, because if LinkedIn or anything goes away tomorrow, then, you know, what are you going to do?
Absolutely. And it's the same as they change their, I mean, they may not go away, but they may change their API if you're using tools.
There's a lot of in between, right? There's a lot of in between between going away and having all the access you do today, right?
Which brings you back to the Google cookie thing. It's just one thing that Google have decided to make a change on, and all of a sudden the industry has changed.
So that's right.
The impact that they have. That's a fantastic thought. I love that. And we could dive into that. So good. But so where might people find other great topics like this?
They'll find it on our little hovel on the internet, our little owned media addressable audience hovel on the internet. It's called contentadvisory.net.
Splendid. I think you should stop calling it a hovel. I mean, it's had three refreshes since you started calling it a hovel.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know that we improve. I don't know that we improve the joint, just to be quite frank. So, yes, it is the current version of the hovel, if you put it that way.
And when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, my friend?
They'll find me on LinkedIn for sure, because that is my favorite platform right now. Although, I have to say, from a personal point of view, I'm very much enjoying Threads. It's fun.
You are. Yeah, you are. And for me, will you be in the bar next week?
Indeed.
I look forward to it, mate. I'll see you. Thank you, Robert. And what are you doing about the demise of third-party cookies? Is it something we should be worrying about in B2B? Let me know what you think. We'll probably be covering that topic again in the podcast pretty soon. So that's a wrap on episode 211, the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. Thanks to Jeff and Robert for sharing their insights. You can find links to them, their work, and all the things we discussed in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com, along with our blog, newsletter, and all of our previous episodes. And thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track, and jiving along with us. I'd love to hear from you, so please say hello or drop us a rating or review in your favourite podcast app, or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, if Jeff and I can remember what day of the week it is, we'll be chatting about the supposed demise of the CMO, and Robert will be back in the virtual bar with a fresh marketing thought. Until then, have a great week, and I hope you'll join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.